Welcome to the History Unplugged podcast, the unscripted show that celebrates unsung heroes, myth busts historical lies, and rediscovers the forgotten stories that changed our world. I'm your host, Scott Rank. Everyone, welcome to our series on the 10 most important battles of the Civil War. We've completed the 10 most important battles of the Civil War. In the previous episode, we looked at the conclusion of the Overland Campaign and the formal terms of surrender of the Confederacy at Appomattox Courthouse. We are by no means ready to wrap up the series. Much like the theatrical and extended version of Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, there is going to be a very long epilogue here because there is so much to cover with the Civil War. This episode isn't so much an epilogue, but it's looking at an issue that we didn't really tie into the rest of the series, and that is the naval war that is occurring in the background of the Civil War. Now, this is nothing new with warfare of a naval battle being fought at the same time as an infantry battle or a land battle. You can look at the Napoleonic Wars.
Take a drink.
Yes, there we are. We've forgotten drinking in this series with when I mentioned Napoleon, when James mentions movies. Is there another thing you drink too?
We said something, but I can't remember what it was like a few episodes ago.
Yeah, I'm sorry, everyone. I haven't really brought in Napoleon. We mentioned glory in a few movies the last few episodes. I promise I'll mention Napoleon more when we look at the epilogue.
you're falling down the jaws.
Yeah, the War of Spanish Succession, which dumps all sorts of pirates into the Caribbean. That's the naval and land battles happening at the same time. So the Civil War is, of course, no exception, but there's interesting things happening with the Civil War because new technology is emerging that's going to forever change how naval war is fought. And there are also questions of strategy. Is it more important to just have good coastal fortifications, or do you want to control the high seas itself for naval supremacy? So these are questions that are taking place at the Civil War. But let's just start off. So, James, what's the background of the naval war in the Civil War?
All right. At the start of the war, the U.S. Navy was very small. It only had about 90 ships. But to make it even more interesting, only about 42 of those were in U.S. ports. The others were off in different parts of the world. And of those that were in U.S. ports, not even all of them were serviceable. So the Navy is just absolutely tiny, tiny, tiny. But despite this, the U.S. had great shipbuilding capacity. The Union had converted merchant ships into naval ships, or they began doing this very quickly, and they were really, really good at this, arming these merchant ships and turning them into combat vessels. So by the end of 1864, just taking a broad sweep here, the U.S. Navy had 671 ships in commission, so a more than tenfold increase. Over 200 were steamships, and 70 were ironclads. We'll talk a little bit more about ironclads later. Very, very important. By the end of the war, the U.S. Navy was the largest navy in the whole world, even larger than the Royal Navy of Britain. They had 65,000 sailors. Secretary of the Navy, Gideon Welles, under Lincoln, reorganized the Navy and made it much more efficient. He was a terrific administrator. He also looked a lot like the mythical figure of Neptune. He had this big, long, white beard. Lincoln actually called him Father Neptune.
He carried around a trident as well, which really completed the look.
Yeah, the trident. Yeah, I don't know if he had the trident, but he should have if he didn't. Here's a movie. I'll throw in a movie quote. Ding. We should have rung a bell every time one of us said it. But in the movie Lincoln, we actually see Lincoln calling him Father Neptune. It's really cool. All right, so the Navy, the Union Navy, the U.S. Navy, which is now the Union Navy, they have a threefold goal. First of all, they need to blockade the southern coast, okay, so keep supply ships from other nations getting in and keep Confederate ships from getting out to take cotton and other goods to trade with other countries. Number two, they need to capture key Confederate ports, which, of course, will make importing things and make trade impossible if you don't have any ports, or almost impossible. And then number three, they needed to support the ground war using the rivers. Now, let's go to the other side and look at the Confederate Navy. The Confederate Navy, at the beginning of the war, did not even exist. There was no Navy at all. Only 237 Union naval officers resigned to join the Confederacy. Very, very few compared to the number that stayed loyal. The South had no shipyards, no machine shops that could build steam engines big enough to power a ship. So an incredible disadvantage for the South, even more so than with the Army. And the South only had three naval yards, New Orleans, Pensacola, and Norfolk. And at Norfolk, though, I do have to say that the Confederates captured 2,000 heavy guns. That's a pretty good haul there. And they captured a ship called the USS Merrimack, which they're going to rename the Virginia, and it's going to have a big future, which we'll talk about a little bit later. By 1862, the Union had recaptured all of the naval yards. So, advantage Union, big time. During the war, the Confederates converted or built 130 ships, including 37 ironclads, and some of the latter had rams. Their job was literally just to crash into another ship and poke a big hole in it. So that's pretty good, 130 ships, considering they had no shipbuilding capacity, no shipyards, and only three naval yards that they didn't have for very long. The Confederate Navy tried to compensate for its numerical inferiority by technology. They came up with a number of innovations, or if they didn't invent them, they improved them. First of all, you had torpedoes, and torpedoes are not what we think of as torpedoes today. When you think of a torpedo, you think of a missile almost that floats through the water and goes far away and blows up the ship. A torpedo back in the time of the Civil War was just a mine. That's what we would call it today. So it's just a floating bomb, essentially. And these torpedoes or mines, by the end of the war, would sink or destroy 49 Union ships. That's pretty good. They also came up with torpedo boats. These are boats that had a big, long projection at the end, kind of like a beak almost. And they would carry a mine on the end, and they would sail up next to a Union ship and then detonate the mine, and it would blow up. Of course, it would blow up the Confederate ship too, but it would be unmanned at that point, and it would blow up the Union ship. And then another thing the Confederacy did, which I think is really interesting, is they invented the very first successful submarine in history.
That's right.
Now, some people might say, well, okay, you had the Turtle in the Revolutionary War, and maybe there are other examples, but they weren't particularly successful. This was an actual submarine that had a crew that floated under the water and actually did damage to a Union ship there. But it was very costly for the Confederacy to develop this ship. It was called the Hunley, by the way. They had two volunteer crews that drowned. So the first volunteer crew drowned, the second one drowned, the third one actually went out, and on February 16th, 1864, it attacked a Union blockade ship with a torpedo or a mine, and they sank the ship, but then the ship itself sank, and we don't even know exactly what happened to the Hunley that time. But so it was very costly just to blow up this one ship. It cost several dozen men. And then they also came up with commerce raiding, and we'll talk about commerce raiding. Of course, commerce raiding wasn't a new thing. It had been around since the dawn of time, but they took it to a new art. We'll talk about that later.
And I think the most critical thing of the naval conflict is the blockade. It's not sexy just to talk about an economic blockade, but when we've looked at other campaigns in the series, the Siege of Vicksburg, the reason Vicksburg is so important is because Confederate logistics are being squeezed into a few very narrow points of entry. You have Texas and then Mexico on one side because you can't bring equipment through the seas. So this is overall crucial to military strategy. So could you describe the blockade a little bit?
Sure. The blockade was proclaimed by Lincoln at the very beginning of the war in April 1861. But at that time, the Union Navy had far too few ships to effectively blockade the southern coast. It was the most porous blockade in history. Huge holes in it. But as the number of ships increased, so did the effectiveness of the blockade. Obviously, the more ships you have to enforce the blockade, the more likely it is they're going to intercept any vessel trying to get in or out. Interestingly enough, I just want to mention one thing in passing. This proclamation of the blockade had interesting international ramifications, because think about what was the Confederacy to Lincoln? Well, the Confederacy claimed to be a sovereign nation, a separate country, right? But to Lincoln, Lincoln never admitted that the states had actually left the Union. His phrasing of it was that the Confederate states had been taken over by a bunch of rebels who had then attempted to leave the Union, but they really didn't. And so the thing is in Lincoln's eyes, and what Lincoln said to everybody is the Confederacy is still part of the U.S. It's just a revolt or a rebellion. It's not like we're fighting another country, like fighting England or France or something. But then he proclaims this blockade. Well, the thing about a blockade is it doesn't make sense to blockade your own country, right? So just by declaring a blockade of the Confederacy, Lincoln is almost de facto granting them recognition as a sovereign nation. Isn't that, that's kind of interesting. And so that had ramifications overseas. The English, especially the British, who used to trade with the Confederacy a lot, they really relied on Southern cotton. The Confederacy cried foul when Lincoln proclaimed the blockade, and they said, well, you can't have, that's not a legal blockade, because according to international law at the time, for a blockade to be valid, it had to be effective. And Lincoln's blockade was very, very ineffective at the beginning. And so they said, this is just a blockade on paper. It's just a nominal blockade. It's not a true blockade. So it's therefore invalid, and we're going to ignore it. But eventually, diplomacy prevailed, and Lincoln prevailed upon the British government not to have formal trading relations with the South, although certainly a lot of individuals traded as well. I mean, it's just kind of an interesting thing there.
And one very short thing I want to mention is this ripples throughout the global economy. So in southern Turkey, the price of cotton explodes due to the blockade on the South, and there's all sorts of economic development that happens there. One of my friends wrote a dissertation on this whole economic development because of the Civil War. So global markets, you're getting to a point in history where we can see the seeds of a global economy taking root.
Yeah, definitely. Okay, so anyway, the first Confederate blockade runner was captured in May of 1861. These are ships that are designed to be fast. They're usually pretty small. Their job is to just get through, go as fast as you can and outrun the Union blockade ships. They don't have a lot of arms and guns. Some of them don't have any. By the end of 1864, though, there were 500 Union ships in the blockade. So it gets harder and harder for Confederate ships to get through the blockade. Now, the Union blockading ships were originally based at Hampton Roads, Virginia, and Key West, Florida. But those are somewhat removed from the coast, especially Key West, and it's too far away from many southern ports. As a result, the Navy decided to seize key inlets. And so by the end of 1861, Union forces had captured Hatteras Inlet, which is off the coast of North Carolina, Ship Island, which is off the coast of Mississippi near Biloxi, and then Port Royal, South Carolina. And this gave the Union a great supply depot and coaling station, all these did, Hatteras Inlet especially. But so they were able to have these bases kind of scattered throughout the area of the blockade, the Atlantic coast as well as the Gulf coast. The Union soon extended its control over the other southern Atlantic coast down to St. Augustine, Florida, and up to Roanoke, North Carolina. So slowly but surely, the blockade spreads and becomes more and more effective. And we'll talk about its effectiveness a little later, but I want to take a little bit of a side note here. Well, actually, I need to take two. I forgot to do this at the beginning, but I want to first of all acknowledge that I'm relying very, very heavily on the notes here. I'm relying on Professor Gary Gallagher. He is a professor of history and one of the leading Civil War scholars of our nation. He is at UVA, University of Virginia, and he has several courses in the Great Courses series put out by the Teaching Company, which I highly recommend. And in particular, I'm referring to his course called The American Civil War. It's 48 lectures, so he really goes in depth. Scott and I, believe it or not, some of y'all are thinking this thing has gone on forever.
You have no idea.
Yeah, we are just, I mean, all we've talked about is battles and occasionally politics or other things, but he goes into everything. What was it like to be a woman in the North, a woman in the South? What's it like to be a free African-American in the North? What's it like to be a farmer? Just it's almost an exhaustive course. And I highly recommend it. If you like what Scott and I are doing, you'll really love that. So I don't mean to put a commercial in, Scott, but I know Scott.
I've been known to do that in the past, so I'll accept it.
Yeah. Scott and I both really love the great courses by the teaching company, and especially their history courses. They always get fantastic lecturers. So check that out, the American Civil War by Professor Gallagher, the teaching company. All right, so that's end of the commercial there, or end of the plug. Now, before we talk about the effectiveness of the blockade, let's go to a famous battle, an epic battle, which I was going to work this in one way or the other, Scott, because I love this story. The Monitor and the Virginia, or some people may think of it as the Monitor and the Merrimack. But so we talked about how the Confederates had captured the USS Merrimack. The Union had tried to scuttle it, in other words, sink it and make it unusable, but they didn't succeed. The Confederacy was able to raise the Merrimack, and they fixed it up, and they turned it into an ironclad, and they renamed it the Virginia. An ironclad is nothing more than, at this point, is a wooden ship with iron plates installed on the outside. And you didn't have this before. This is not the first ironclad ever created. The British were experimenting with it, and I think other nations were as well, but this is the first ironclad in U.S. history. And the Virginia is, so you've got this monster ship, and when you fire cannonballs and other shells, other artillery at it, they just bounce off. The Virginia was sent to break up the Union blockade near Norfolk, Virginia. And on its first day, March 8th, 1862, it destroyed two Union vessels and damaged three others. So this thing is a beast, man. It's a monster and scares the crud out of the Union. It's just going around creating destruction everywhere it goes. But the next day, things are going to be a little bit different. So the next day is March 9th. The Virginia goes out to do more damage. They're going to finish up the other ships and maybe wipe out some more. But it runs into a new opponent, and this is the USS Monitor, and this is the Union's answer to the Virginia or the Merrimack. This is the first ironclad created in Northern history, not American history, because I guess technically the Confederacy is part of America, right? At least that's what Lincoln said. But the Monitor is a new kind of ship, whereas the Virginia was just a regular ship with iron plates stuck on it. The Monitor is a completely new design, and it's a very funny looking thing. Everybody looked at it and said, that is weird, or that is just ugly, but ugly. I mean, it was like a cheese. Somebody said it was like a cheese box how did they describe it? Well, anyway, I won't try to recall that off the top of my head, the quote, but it sat very, very low in the water, almost like a submarine, like a modern submarine, but much smaller, of course. Most of the ship was actually below the surface of the water. It was flat on the top, and it had a turret that stuck up above the level of water, and it was a rotating turret. So it only had two guns, and that was pretty radical because most ships would have a lot more than two, but it only needed two because it could just rotate around.
You don't have to turn your whole ship around like before.
Right, yeah. Before, since the time of the Romans, the Greeks, even earlier perhaps, if you wanted to fire in a different direction, you had to move the whole ship, but not anymore. Now, with the Monitor, you just move the turret and fire wherever you want. The two ships fought. Basically, it was a tie or a draw. It was off of Hampton Roads. Neither one was a clear winner. But this was one of these turning points in history, because now wooden ships are obsolete. That's just this. The future of naval combat has arrived. Ironclad vessels are going to take over and completely dominate naval combat up to the present. The London Times commented on this, and they wrote, before the duel off Hampton Roads, the Royal Navy had 149 first-class warships. After the battle, it has just two. So it's like, well, great. Those two experimental ironclads, we better hurry up and finish them. The rest are useless now. So as the Union Army marched up the peninsula toward Richmond, remember this is McClellan's slow plodding campaign, the Virginia had to go upriver. That's the Confederate ironclad. They couldn't keep it down near where the Union troops were or it would be captured. So they go up the river. Eventually the water is too shallow and the ship had to be scuttled. So That's the end of the Confederate ironclad, at least the Virginia. The Union would go on to make several more boats, just like the Monitor. In fact, Monitor becomes the name of a class of ships, to where you can start saying we have a Monitor class ship, or just we have a Monitor. The Confederacy is going to make some more ironclads as well, but not nearly as many as the Union.
Hey everyone, want to take a short break in this episode on our narrative on the Civil War. I want to mention a way how you can help support this show. And you can do so by saving big with a great new product from a company called Candid. Candid basically takes all of the misery out of adult orthodontia. There's millions of people at any given time in the United States who have wire braces, and there are many, many millions more who should be wearing retainers and aren't and need a tooth straightening solution. Well, Candid is a company that makes it possible to get tooth straightening without ever having to visit an orthodontist, without ever having to leave your home, and to get it all done much more cheaply and in a fraction of the time of conventional orthodontia. The way it works is that Candid sends a modeling kit to your home so you can take impressions of your teeth. After you send back your impressions with some photos of your teeth, a network of orthodontists reviews your case and provides you with a 3D preview of what your treatment will look like. After you receive your 3D preview, it's up to you if you want to go forward or not with a tooth aligner treatment plan. And when you get your treatment plan, it results in straighter and brighter teeth in an average of 6 months and can cost thousands of dollars less than braces. And again, no office visits are needed. Everything is delivered to your home. You can take advantage of Candid's risk-free modeling kit guarantee. And when you use my dedicated link, candidco.com/unplugged, you'll save 25% off your modeling kit. That's candidco.com/unplugged to get 25% off the price of your modeling kit. candidco.com/unplugged. And just as an aside, it should be understood that these are all steam vessels. I wouldn't want to imagine a sail-powered iron vessel, but we're well past the point of sail ships in conflict. This is take a drink, well past the Napoleonic Wars of, if you know the Russell Crowe movie, Master and Commander, with the large sail ships firing cannon against one another, get that out of your head, because that's not what's happening here.
Right. Speaking of movies, ding.
Yeah, two right there in a row.
Yeah. They're going to be feeling good in a little bit here. There was a movie made. It was a made-for-TV. I don't know if it was TNT or which network, called Ironclads, about this battle. But I can't find a copy of it anywhere. It's out of print. You can't go on Amazon and buy the DVD. At least I don't think. Maybe you can, but maybe I need to check again.
Right. I mean, in film,
it's probably not a very good movie. I wouldn't recommend it necessarily, based on the ratings anyway.
It's tricky because what you imagine in your mind of naval combat, it's either wooden vessels, Pirates of the Caribbean or whatever, or then you jump up to the World War II, Tora. And so we're in a middle point here that isn't really depicted on film or television very much.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There needs to be a movie about this. It's an exciting time and a momental time. I can't talk anymore all of a sudden, but it's a momentous time in naval history. Anyway, so if you're listening, if you're a movie producer, please make a movie about this.
We'll take executive producer credits along the way.
That's right. We'll be your consultants. Actually, you may want to get somebody that knows more about it than me. But so let's talk about some successes of the Union Army, a Navy rather. We're talking about naval combat. So the Union Army and Navy in a joint effort captured New Orleans on April 25th, 1862. We talked about that long ago, but here I just want to stress the role that the Navy played. It was crucial. And then let's talk about Mobile. We talked about a few episodes ago about how Nathaniel Banks was supposed to go attack Mobile and he didn't, but they decided to sick the Navy on him. And so Admiral David G. Farragut, who had been the naval commander at New Orleans, he's in command of the squadron that's going to take Mobile, or at least attack Mobile. This is a great story. I love this. So Admiral Farragut ordered that the forts guarding the harbor, Mobile Harbor, that they be bombarded. And the Union vessels went into the harbor in a single line. And the first Union ship hit a mine, or a torpedo as they would have called it, and was damaged heavily. Farragut pulled his ship, the flagship, into the lead position, which was not ironclad. And I'm not even sure if it was a steamship or not. I was definitely wooden, though. But anyway, so Farragut, he's watching this, and he's seeing that there are mines in the harbor, and they're causing damage to one or more of his ships. And some of his officers went up to him and said, sir, there's torpedoes in the harbor. And he gave this famous quote, which I love so much, and everybody's heard this. He said, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. That's where that phrase comes from, damn the torpedoes. It came from the Civil War. And Admiral Farragut. Farragut had vertigo, and he was struggling with standing up. So he had himself lashed to the mast.
Did he hear the siren song, too, and put wax in his ears?
I don't think so, but maybe it would have at least drowned out the sound of all the cannon. But anyway, eventually the Union ships prevail. They do capture the harbor. They don't capture the city, but they make the port unusable. And then finally, we've seen that these ports fall one by one. And finally, in January of 1865, Wilmington, North Carolina, which is the last major Confederate port, it falls. And that's it. No more open ports. Of course, by this time, the war's almost over. They didn't know that at the time, of course. But anyway, so it took some time. But over time, the Union Navy did prevail and did, with the help of the Army, gradually knock out all the Confederate ports.
So how well does the blockade's effectiveness work? You said in the beginning it is very porous and essentially a blockade in name only.
Yeah, I wasn't able to get the stat on the beginning. I've heard it. I couldn't seem to dig it up for whatever reason. Maybe somebody can do that. But I think at the beginning of the war, only one out of eight or maybe one out of 10 Confederate blockade runners were captured. So very, very few. It may have even been a smaller ratio. I'm not sure. But regardless of what the exact ratio is, if you were a Confederate blockade runner, your odds were really good at the beginning of the war, and you might actually make some really good money. But by the end of the war, one in two Confederate ships were captured. So by then, you had a 50-50 chance. And just that alone dissuaded quite a few people who might have been blockade runners earlier in the war. They might have just decided, nah, it's not worth it. Because if you get caught, you lose everything. In all, about 8,500 vessels got through the blockade. About 1,500 were captured. So that's about a 15% capture rate overall for the entire war. So again, pretty good odds for the blockade runners, but bummer if you get caught. The Confederacy managed to import 600,000 rifles, 600,000 pairs of shoes, millions of pounds of lead, food, and other supplies. So that's pretty good haul, don't you think?
Yeah, it's interesting that the Confederate economy was basically a gigantic black market, a legitimized black market that still managed to fund a war effort for several years, which is incredible if you think about it.
Yeah, it is amazing that they were able to keep it going for 4 years. Confederate blockade runners that did get through, they were fast, as I mentioned, but they were small. They couldn't carry a lot of cargo, so you had to have a lot of ships going in and out to bring all this stuff over. The question, some scholars have argued, well, the blockade was not effective because obviously look at that 600,000 rifles, all the food, millions of pounds of supplies. But on the other hand, think of what would have gone through if they had not had the blockade. Let me go back and restate the number. In the 4 years of the Civil War, about 8,500 vessels got through. But in the 4 years prior to the war, there were 20,000 ships that went in and out of southern ports. Hmm. So you could argue that it cut it in more than half. So I guess it depends on the way you look at it, with half full, half empty. But Dr. Gallagher, the professor that I mentioned earlier that did the Civil War lecture series for the teaching company, he estimates that the blockade cut southern commerce to about one-third of its pre-war level. So if you measure it that way, then it was definitely successful, especially in the last couple of years.
Well, another big aspect too, we talk about coasts and we think of naval warfare as being purely oceanic, but one of the reasons that America as a nation is able to develop so quickly in its history is because we have such an extensive river network. And unlike other places in the world, unlike maybe Africa, for example, that has lots of waterfalls, We don't have that. So you can travel very far on a river that just makes it easier to develop America economically than other geographic places. So rivers are a big deal in America, and that figures into naval combat too. So what's going on with the River War?
All right, the River War. Well, as you touched upon, and we've talked about this quite some time ago, very early on, the western part of the Confederacy had several rivers that cut into it, and these offered the Union great invasion routes, much better and much more efficient than trying to go over land or even by rail, which the rails tended to get destroyed by people like Nathan Bedford Forrest and others. But the rivers, you think about all these rivers, the Mississippi cuts right into the Confederacy, the Tennessee River and the Cumberland, which go through Kentucky and Tennessee and others. And the Union realized early on that it would need a river fleet to take advantage of these watery invasion routes. And the Confederacy, of course, wanted to stop this from happening, and so they built fortifications among all of them. All right, so let's talk specifically about Union river vessels. What were they like, and how were they different from open sea vessels? River boats had to have powerful guns, of course, to go against Confederate fortifications, but they had to also have shallow drafts so that they could float in as little as 10 feet of water. And when I say shallow drafts, that's a fancy way of just saying they can't go too far below the water, because sometimes the rivers are quite shallow, especially in times of drought or in times where there hasn't been a lot of rain. And the first set of Union river vessels were made of wood, and they were called timber clads, of course, because they're clad or made or built with timber or wood, and they were commissioned in June of 1861. But naturally, the Union eventually, once it's able to, they switched to ironclads. Seven of these were built early in the war, and the river ironclads were about 175 feet long, and they had slanted sides, and they typically had about 13 guns, so they weren't monitor class ships. They were just more traditional design. They could move 5 miles per hour upstream and 8 miles per hour downstream, which is not blindingly fast, but it's pretty good pace. And they were all in action by January of 1862.
Yeah, and from what I've seen of riverboats, they're very box-shaped, because you mentioned they don't have too much of a, they have a very shallow draft. Would these military vessels also have that similar box-shaped riverboat appearance?
They were a little bit more sleek. They had slanted sides. So don't think like a box with a turret on the top, like a monitor. Think more like the Merrimack or the Virginia, a little bit more of a traditional ship design with slanting sides. And they were designed that way. One reason they were designed that way is so that shells and other artillery and things that landed on them would just hit and just roll right off into the water. Hmm. Yeah. All right. So let's talk about the first naval engagement. And we've already touched on these, but let's talk about them again, because it's been a long time. And these are key river battles. First of all, Fort Henry. Fort Henry was in the state of Tennessee, and it was along the Cumberland River. And the Union fleet was commanded by Andrew Foote. On February 2nd of 1862, Foote and seven vessels escorted General Grant. Still at this time, of course, he was in the West. About 17,000 soldiers. So together, the Navy and the Army are marching toward Fort Henry. Fort Henry was poorly designed. It was too low to the ground. It wasn't high up. In fact, it was so low that the fort would take in water when the river flooded. That's not very good, is it? You don't want your fort to start flooding right in the middle of an attack. And it did, and sure enough, it did this right before the Union boats arrived. One of the Union boats actually sailed into and out of the fort itself. That's just hard to imagine. We weren't thinking, guys, when we designed this.
Going to get trench foot inside the fort. Fort foot, they call it.
No kidding. On February 6th, the Union boats bombarded the fort. The defenders surrendered. And this is the only time in the war that a fort actually surrendered to a fleet. Huh. So they surrendered not to an army, but to the Navy. And this opened the Tennessee River. I think I said the wrong river a minute ago. Tennessee River, not Cumberland. On the Cumberland was Fort Donelson. After defeating Fort Henry, The Union fleet went back up the Tennessee. They had to go back north to the Ohio River and then get into the Cumberland to Fort Donelson. On February 15th, the fleet fired on the fort, but they were turned back. Donelson was much tougher, much more powerful guns, much better situated than Fort Henry. The next day, the fleet attacked again while Grant's army surrounded it. The fort surrendered this time, and now the Cumberland River was open to the Union Navy. So the Tennessee and the Cumberland River were pretty much wide open, and most of Middle and East Tennessee soon fell into Union hands. So we see here that control of the rivers leads to control of the state, just about, except for, I think I said East. I keep making mistakes here. It's Middle and West Tennessee. East Tennessee is going to take a lot longer, as we saw in our lectures or our lessons earlier, episodes.
Very critical. I mean, for provisioning troops, for sending supplies up and down, think of them as watery rail lines. And throughout history, it's always cheaper and more effective in terms of moving tonnage to send things by water, by boat, than it is to send it over land. Not quite as true with the advent of the rail lines, but you can blow up a rail line. You can't blow up a river. So control of this for logistics later on of river lines is very critical.
It really is. And during the Battle of Shiloh, one of our key battles that we talked about, major battle in the West very early in the war, two Union gunboats helped the Army. They were on the river and they were blasting into the Confederate lines. So they, I'm not going to say they turned the tide or anything like that, but they sure did help. Mm-hmm. All right, let's talk about the Mississippi now. Island number 10 was, surprise, surprise, it was a little island in the river, and it had a Confederate fortress. It fell to a joint gunboat and Army force in early 1862. New Orleans and Baton Rouge, we saw, they fell in 1862 as well. In May of 1862, a Union flotilla faced a group of Confederate rams near Memphis. We talked about the rams earlier. Two Union vessels were sunk, but they were later raised. Another naval battle ensued, and Memphis fell soon afterwards. So in 1862, these Confederate strongholds on the rivers they're dropping like flies. At Vicksburg, the Union River fleet played a key role in the capture of the city. We talked about that in quite some detail when we talked about Vicksburg, how the Union River flotilla just bypassed the fort, just ran the guns, and they took some heat, but they got past it. Most of them survived, and then they ferried Grant's troops across the river, enabling him to attack Vicksburg. So, in sum, without the support of the Union River fleet, the war in the West would not have gone so well. It played a critical role in helping out the Army.
And remember, when James and I talked about Vicksburg, we said that some people call it not the turning point of the war, but a turning point of the war, because now the Confederacy is both blocked off by the naval blockade, but it's essentially blocked off to the west from Texas, from Mexico, from getting those supplies. That's because of the importance of a blockade. That's because the importance of naval warfare, of ferrying supplies by means of water. So you can't discount it if Vicksburg is a turning point in the war, because how important it is to get access to the sea or to get access by the river networks. And so speaking of which, we've talked about the blockade, we've talked about the river war. So how about naval conflict on the open seas? What's happening there?
All righty. So we talked about, again, the Confederates were trying to break up the blockade, reduce its effectiveness, get through it, things like that. The Confederacy actually commissioned some ironclads, and their job was to go sneak up on the Union vessels that were keeping the blockade and try to destroy them. Some ships would be equipped with a ram. Again, we've seen rams in the past. These ramming ships were built in British shipyards. So the British were kind of turning a blind eye to this. They weren't supposed to be doing this. They were a neutral nation, but there were some British companies that were building these ships for the Confederacy. Some of them got away, but others were confiscated by the British Navy after American protests. And you got to give credit here to the American ambassador to Great Britain, who was Charles Francis Adams, the son of John Quincy and grandson of John Adams. Oh. He played a key role in getting this to stop, basically. We can't have a country that we're technically friends with, Britain, allowing these ships to be built that are destroying our blockade ships. So the ironclads had very limited success. Then you also had privateers. Privateers have a long and glorious tradition in naval history. They're essentially a pirate that is given sanction by a government. So Jefferson Davis offered anyone who would become a privateer a commission in the Confederate Navy, or at least maybe not officially in the Navy, more like an irregular captain or irregular unit. But so if you, let's say you're a Confederate citizen and you have a ship and you have a crew, you can go and attack Union vessels that are out in the open sea, merchant vessels, and you can capture them, capture the crew, or just take away all the stuff, steal everything, and bring it back, and you get to keep it. So you deprive the Union of much-needed supplies or money or whatever, and you give some of it to the government, and you keep some, and you become rich. Many Southern ship owners responded, but overall they didn't have a huge effect. What did have a more of an effect were commerce raiders. Commerce, and we touched on this earlier in our when we discussed the very, very end of the war, but let's go into a little bit more detail. Commerce raiders, unlike blockade runners, remember we talked about blockade running ships were designed to be small and fast. These are also designed to be fast, but they're designed to be heavily armed. Their job was to attack and capture or destroy Northern merchant marine vessels. So they're like privateers, but they are actually officially sanctioned and run by the Confederate government, the Confederate Navy. They would be fast enough to outrun Union naval vessels. That was the plan anyway. And there's a colorful character we'll bring in here. We haven't mentioned him at all yet. The most famous commerce raider in the Confederacy was Captain Raphael Semmes. And his first command was the Sumter, appropriately named after Fort Sumter, the crew of which included 20 Confederate Marines. Interestingly enough, did you know there were Confederate Marines?
I did not. That's interesting.
The few, the proud. There's very few, 20 of them. No, there were more than 20, but this ship had 20 alone. All right, so in June of 1861, this commerce raider led by Raphael Semmes, the Sumter, they set sail into the Gulf of Mexico. And after 6 months, it had captured 18 Union merchant vessels. That's pretty good. 6 months, 18. They captured 18 merchant vessels. That's three a month. Finally, Semmes had to put in at Gibraltar, and he was forced to give up his ship. But he personally got away, and he escaped to London. In the summer of 1862, Semmes left England with three ships now. So he's got not one new ship, but three. And in the Azores, one of the ships was converted into the CSS Alabama. And the Alabama sailed around the world, literally. Along this route, the Alabama captured 65 U.S. merchant ships.
Wow.
Pretty impressive, but compared to the total number of U.S. merchant ships, that's not that many. But still, it's significant. Off the coast of France, the Alabama was confronted by the USS Kearsarge. I don't know if I pronounced that right, but I've only read it. But anyway, they fought a battle on June 15th. Thousands of people watched this sea battle from the coast. It's great entertainment if you can find it, right? Just one-on-one, one ship on another, head-to-head.
The Civil War in Europe. Don't think of that very much.
You really don't. Yeah, you certainly. But here you got these ships duking it out off the coast of France. Well, the Alabama was sunk. The Union ship was better. Semmes once again escapes, and other major Confederate commerce raiders were the Florida, who took 55 prizes, and the Shenandoah, who took 38 prizes. And the Shenandoah, as we saw in a previous episode, took on the U.S. whaling fleet in the Bering Sea. This was after Appomattox. It did not surrender until November of 1865. It actually sailed away. Surrender is not the right word.
So this is for geography people who aren't aware, this is between Russia and Alaska.
Yeah, and we didn't even control Alaska at the time. Not that that really matters, but it's just your point is it was way far away from all the rest of the fighting. So the Civil War wasn't just fought in the United States. I mean, we see naval battles off the coast of France, off the coast of Alaska, which at the time belonged to Russia. And so it went all over the place, at least the naval war did. All in all, to sum up, commerce raiders destroyed 257 northern merchant ships. But despite this, as I mentioned before, that's really just a drop in the bucket because there were thousands and thousands of Union merchant ships. Union commerce was not greatly affected. Many northern commercial vessels just flew the flags of other countries. That's one way they would get away from it. So in all, to sum up, I guess, let me say that the Confederates did the absolute best they could. They had overwhelming odds against them. They really were lacking in naval technology, naval yards. They didn't have what we certainly not what we'd call a naval base today. But despite this, they did the best they could, and they put some serious hurt on the Union ships, but it just wasn't enough in the end.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Yeah, this is a good extended excursus to look into because the focus of the series has been on major Civil War battles. But even if we're not looking at direct naval engagements, river fleets and also fleets on the open sea had very important impact on the war. The Siege of Vicksburg. Vicksburg was bombarded continuously. Was it by river fleets or was it fleets in the Gulf?
Yeah, Vicksburg is on the Mississippi. Okay. It's pretty far north of the Gulf. So it was bombarded. Well, primarily it was bombarded by land forces, but for a while it was attacked also from the river.
Right. So even on engagements that we would think mostly as land engagements, if it's close to a river, they are getting involved, to say nothing of how the blockade affects commerce, how it affects the overall war effort, which the Confederacy is critically short of supplies later on. So you can well argue that it was successful. So yeah, this is an important component of the war as well. Well, we have finished up the war, but we are still not done with the series. Like in The Lord of the Rings, then you get into all the appendices that Tolkien has at the end. Something to look into is what happens to all of these figures that we followed throughout the war? What happens to the politicians and the generals? Because the background of many of these people is very eclectic. Unlike today, where you would expect a general to be a career military man, because where else would you find a general? Many of these people were bankers, priests, or even more eclectic backgrounds. So what happens to them once the war ends and the U.S. is mostly demilitarized? And then we're also going to look at the long-term changes that happen in the United States in the political, military, social, and technological realms. And then we're also going to look at historiography, which is just a fancy way of saying, how is history made? And how is the history of the Civil War itself understood, which is still an ongoing debate, sometimes a fierce debate. What started the war? Was it slavery? Was it states' rights? Was it a mix of the two? These issues that people still argue about today. So we'll get into all of those things in the next episode. All right, well, that was the episode for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. First of all, I'd like to thank the Knowlton's Rangers, and especially our spy masters, Baron Freyza, Carl from Norway, Chris from Maine, and Melissa Sarnowski. And I'll explain what that means in a second. If you want to support the show and help me keep producing this content, there are four easy ways for you to do it. One, subscribe to the show and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you want to do that, you can go to historyunplugpodcast.com and there you'll find instructions. Two, join our Facebook group, which you can find if you just search for History Unplugged. And please like and share posts that I put up about new episodes. 3, submit a question to me so that I can answer it on air. You can email me at info@historyonthenet.com or leave a voicemail. And again, go to historyunplugpodcast.com and you'll find instructions. Lastly, and I think this one is the best, is to become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. The Knowlton's Rangers were an elite reconnaissance and espionage detachment of the Continental Army in the Revolutionary War, but it's also the name of the History Unplugged membership program. Learn how to join by going to patreon.com/unplugged. So here's what you get if you become one of the Knowlton's Rangers. If you join at the level of Scout, you can get early access to new podcast episodes, along with enjoying absolutely every single episode of the History Unplugged podcast ad-free. All 270 and counting episodes. If you join at the level of Intelligence Officer, you can also get access to premium episodes, like a multi-part series on the life of Audie Murphy, the most decorated combat soldier in World War II, or the 10-part series Ottoman Lives, a series that looks at the cast of characters that made up the Ottoman Empire, such as the Sultan, the Eunuch, the Harem Servant Girl, and the Soldier. And finally, if you join at the level of Spymaster, you get all the same stuff as the Scouts and Intelligence Officers, but you also get a shout-out to you and or your business at the end of each episode, a 3-pack of hardcover history books, plus you'll be put at the very front of the line for me to answer your question about history, and I can guarantee I will dedicate an episode that's about an hour long or so to your question. Sign up at patreon.com/unplugged. Again, that's patreon.com/unplugged. Anyway, those are the ways you can help out the show. Thank you so much for your support. Thanks for listening to the History Unplugged podcast. Be sure to subscribe to the show to get your daily dose of all things history related, from ancient Greece to the Cold War. We'll see you next time at the History Unplugged podcast.
They were some of the most powerful men who've ever lived. They waged war, forged peace, and altered the fates of billions of people. And yet, they were just as human, just as flawed as you and me. They were the presidents of the United States, and they are the subjects of the history podcast, This American President. In each episode of This American President, we explore how flawed men have managed this awesome responsibility. To listen now, go to parthenonpodcast.com or search This American President on your favorite podcast platform.